Hello and welcome back to Sunday Seminary. We're going to shift a little bit in terms of the way that I'm presenting the material and the kind of visual aspect of it. We're going to focus on the biblical text. We're going to be reading really short bits of biblical text for the rest of the semester, focusing on the Elijah and Elisha stories. So what I'll use here visually, I'll just show you a little bit of what I'm doing, but also the text around me that you see comes from a program called Accordance. There's actually a really good online free Bible program that is called Bible Web App, and I think there are a couple of others like that, help you to search for words, and you can use it like a concordance. That means if you see a particular word and you're wondering about how it's used or what it means, you can like look up where else it's used in the Bible and so on. So above me, right above me, is the Hebrew text, and then to the side over here is the English text. I'm using the ESV here just because it comes free with the program, but I myself read the NRSV more often, and so I'll be referencing kind of both of these as we go along. The ESV is a fine translation, the English Standard Version. Another one that came out recently is the Contemporary English Bible, the CEB, which is also a good translation. But in any event, I might from time to time refer to some of these Hebrew words up here, but don't worry, I won't expect you to read them. I'll just show you them from time to time. Like this, right here, this is the name Omri in Hebrew. In Hebrew, you read right to left, and so you can see it links up the two kind of blue squares there. So I'm going to enlarge this just so you can see it. I think that's maybe as large as that gets there. There's a Omri in Hebrew and Omri in English, the name there. So in any event, what we're talking about today is chapter 17 of 1 Kings, verses 1 through 16, which is an amazing story, actually two stories put together. But whenever I read a story, or at least whenever I start kind of dive into a particular biblical text, I always take a look a little bit before it. That is, I look to see if I just jump into 1 Kings chapter 17, I want to know a little bit about what came before. And I think it's really important in this respect. If you just look at your Bibles at 1 Kings 16, you'll see it begins with this really tumultuous period in the history of the kingdom of Israel, the northern kingdom, the kingdom that split apart after Solomon's death. And was founded by Jeroboam. You'll hear about this kind of sin of Jeroboam. Remember, he made the golden calves, and he put one in Bethel and one in Dan, and he asked people to worship them. As I said last week, I think he was trying to make images of Yahweh. So he wasn't worshiping a different god necessarily. But we do find that act of making an image that's associated with Yahweh is then linked to the worship of other gods. It's kind of like a gateway drug, you might say, in the way that the Deuteronomistic historian, the person who's responsible for putting together all of really Joshua and Judges and 1st, 2nd Samuel and 1st, 2nd Kings, which creates a big narrative arc for Israel going into the land and then coming out of the land. All of that is, in a way, encapsulated. All of the sin of Israel is encapsulated by the apostasy of Jeroboam. So we'll talk a little bit about idols and so on, too. But so there's this instability in the kingdom, the northern kingdom of Israel. You can see the Baasha and so on, this very short-lived reign. There's a lot of assassinations that happened. Zimri assassinates Baasha and then takes over, and then Omri kills Zimri. And then Omri begins to reign starting in verse 21. Then Omri builds Samaria. Samaria was just a hill before that, and he builds his own capital city, which I mentioned last time. And then Omri dies. And so here I've got 1 Kings 16, verse 28, and Omri slept with his fathers. This is just the way to say he was buried in the same place that his ancestors were buried, and was buried in Samaria. Interesting, because his ancestors definitely weren't buried in Samaria. That was a new place. He made it. By the way, Samaria kind of means to watch over something. It's the lookout point. It's a big hill in Israel. So it was kind of an observational place, if you've like the panopticon kind of, surveying the land and so on. And then Ahab, his son, reigned in his place. So Ahab takes over as king after Omri. This is the first successful transition of power since Jeroboam himself. So this is a momentous occasion for the northern kingdom, which looked like it was about to fall apart before Omri took over. So then, chapter 16, verse 29, in the 30th year of Asa, king of Judah, This is the southern kingdom, so they're kind of dating the kings by each other. Ahab, the son of Omri, began to reign over Israel. And Ahab, the son of Omri, reigned over Israel in Samaria 22 years. So he had a good long reign. As I said before, Omri had a big long reign too. And then Ahab, his son, has a big long reign. That is, there's an actual dynasty forming. Ahab seems to have a very successful kingship, a very successful reign. Seems to be very stable. So this all to say that this is the same as Omri, who is said to be a very terrible king by the person who's responsible for writing Kings. Omri is judged very harshly because he led Israel into apostasy. So this seemed to be the exact opposite, really, of what they're supposed to do. But also, it's interesting that Omri and Ahab both have strong dynasties, strong reigns, and they are criticized mercilessly. So they are not being evaluated by whether or not they're successful in war or successful in raising money or building a kingdom. They're just being evaluated on whether or not they are faithful to the covenant with Yahweh, the exclusive relationship with Yahweh. That's really important because that's what Elijah is all about, is the exclusive relationship with Yahweh. So then, verse 30 of chapter 16, and Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord. This is the apostasy stuff, more than all who were before him. So though this is we're getting into the problem with to which Elijah is responding. And then 1 Kings 16, 31, and as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, that is, this forefather of his, not related in blood, but the first king of the northern kingdom, and that is to this kind of apostasy, worshiping other gods. If it wasn't so bad that he did that, then he also took Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, the king of the Sidonians, and went and served Baal and worshipped him. So if you remember Solomon's downfall in 1 Kings 11, it's because he built these temples to other gods and he married these foreign women and so on. This is a repeating pattern in the Old Testament that oftentimes the foibles of men in charge are blamed on foreign women. I think probably the men had the problems in themselves. The foreign women are oftentimes objects of scorn. We'll talk a little bit more about how Jezebel plays this role. It's kind of an object of scorn and of like kind of hatred. This has been used in very negative ways and disruptive and harmful ways throughout American history. Calling women Jezebels has been used to hurt people for centuries. And this is a negative impact of this kind of negative portrayal of Jezebel in the Book of Kings. But the reason that the author of Kings is so angry at Jezebel is not because she's a foreigner, a Sidonian. As we see, Elijah goes to these foreign people and tries to help them, even in the same story, in chapter 17. The reason that the author of Kings is so mad at Jezebel is because Ahab and Jezebel together decide to build cults, like, you know, worship sites, and build up the priesthood that would serve these foreign gods, the god of Baal being one of them. As I said last week, Baal really means like master or lord. It was a title given to the storm god, whose proper name would have been Hadad, but no one here in this time and place, like Jezebel, like would have called the god that. They just called the god Baal. But so Baal was the storm god, the one who brought the rains, which made the crops grow. So it was a god associated with like economic productivity and the growth of the land. So if you wanted a good crop, if you wanted to make money, you got to pray to Baal. But then also Baal was the warrior god. Baal was the active one of the Canaanite pantheon. Aol was the name of the high god who created the world and was worshipped for that, but also had become very old at that point in time and got drunk a lot and fell asleep during the day and was not taking care of the world. Baal was the one who really took over as one of the most active gods of the pantheon. And Baal's sister, Anat, was a warrior goddess who also worked with Baal and so on. But here Baal is receiving the full brunt of this author's anger. So I think what's really important that we have to kind of set the scene here is that in the ancient world, worshiping a god was very unlike worshiping a god today. So today people say, well, you know, I feel like going to this church this week. I feel like going to that church this week. Or maybe I'm going to like say some Buddhist prayers today and like see if that does anything. Maybe I'll visit a mosque and try that on for a little bit. I'm going to read some Rumi, a Muslim poet, and just kind of see if that affects me spiritually, or I'm spiritual but not religious, or all gods are one. I mean, people in the ancient world would have thought we were, you know, we lost our marbles, right? That was not the way that ancient worship worked. Ancient worship wasn't primarily about singing. It wasn't primarily about going even to a particular place. It wasn't about an identity that you put on it and tried out and then would like throw away or something, or try something else on, or like try to combine them. In the ancient world, when you worshipped a god or a set of gods, a pantheon, you know, a certain kind of group of gods and goddesses, when you did that, you served them with your whole life. You created a structure to try to serve them. So in the ancient world, they had temples as places to gather the food that was harvested by the laborers. In the minds of the people, they thought that this food was being eaten by the gods. The gods needed to eat food in the ancient world. That was the way people understood how gods worked, that they had real bodies. They could, like, their bodies could do more than human bodies could do. They were more powerful than humans, but they still had limitations. They had limited minds. Gods could be confused or tricked. Just think about the stories of the Greek gods. You know, they have limitations, they have emotions, they fly off the handle sometimes, they do things that are ridiculous, they get punished by other gods, right? So if you think about the ancient world, they thought that gods were limited, that gods had physical bodies, but also could manifest in certain things, like in natural things, like in a creek or in a tree, but they also thought the gods could manifest in a statue. They didn't think the god was limited to the statue, but they thought the god could show up in a cult statue, in a statue in a temple. They thought that the gods could kind of occupy this statue in the temple and then really eat this particular food that was brought in, and that they needed that food. The basic idea of the ancient world was that the gods created humans to be slaves of the gods so that the gods could not work. Some of the gods didn't like to work in the ancient world, and they had to farm, right? And so they made the humans to farm for them. This is the story that was told throughout the ancient world, from Egypt to Mesopotamia, about why humans do what they do. If you build a temple to Baal, you are instituting a particular economic structure. You are instituting a particular political structure. And that political and economic structure and theological structure is this. Now the person in charge has to make sure that all the peasants are bringing all their excess food to the temple so that the gods can consume it. And the priests, of course, are the real ones consuming this, and the nobles and so on, but they don't tell that. It's a secret. The Bible has a story in a part of the book of Daniel that is like on certain communities see it as Bible and certain communities don't. It's kind of an addition to the book of Daniel. It's called Bel and the Dragon. And it's a story where Daniel, like through his kind of scientific inquiry and his detective skills, figures out that it's the priests eating the food at night that the people bring. He proves that the foreign gods aren't real and eating the food and so on. So in ancient Israel, they had this idea that yes, you're supposed to bring food to the temple, but God doesn't eat it. Yahweh, the God of Israel, is never said to eat the food in the Bible. And in fact, they say that God smells the odor and likes it when you cook the food at the temple. But then the priests eat the food, and you, the person who brings the sacrifice, you eat the food. And anyone that you've harmed, you have a reconciliation meal with, and you eat the food together. So the community is created through the eating of the food. God is pleased by not eating the food, but God is pleased by the community being reconciled. And then also the temple is supposed to store a lot of their food away to feed the poor, to feed the vulnerable, the widows and the orphans and the wandering aliens who are among us. That is what we're supposed to be doing with our resources, and that's how we're supposed to structure our culture. And as a part of this, humans aren't slaves to God in the Old Testament, and the ancient Israelite way of seeing humans. Instead, humans are partners, covenant partners. Humans are married to God. So the covenant is a radical idea in the ancient world. Humans didn't make covenants with gods in the ancient world, because that's a deal, a business arrangement. Why would a god make a business arrangement or a marriage arrangement? Marriages were covenants, just like signing a contract. And in Jewish tradition, the ketuvah, they actually still have a contract signing ceremony. That's from this ancient idea of covenant. So in the ancient world, gods didn't make covenants with people and with a group of people. But instead, in the Old Testament, Yahweh does. It's a distinctive thing about ancient Israelite religion that they think that the God of the universe, the God who created the whole world, made a covenant arrangement with the people, not with a king, not with a priest, but with the whole people. So all the people and God made this covenant, which is symbolized through like a marriage arrangement. It's, you know, Israel together, the community of all of the people, high and low born, right? The rich and the poor, the vulnerable and the wealthy, everyone together is in a marriage arrangement with God, Yahweh, the one God. It's exclusive. So this is also unusual because in the ancient world, there were lots of gods. Everyone thought there were gods everywhere. Everyone was polytheistic. You might worship certain gods, but you didn't tell other people not to worship their gods. But in Israel, Yahweh says, we're exclusive, and we're exclusive because I don't want you building your society like Baal wants you to build it. I don't want you building your society like Marduk, the god of the Babylonians, wants you to build it, or like Horus and Isis and Ra, the gods of Egypt, want you to. I destroyed a lot of Egypt and brought out the Israelite slaves, the Hebrew slaves, in order to build a new people who would do this all radically differently, right? So, all to say, when they worship a god, when they worship foreign gods, when Solomon worships foreign gods, when Omri and Jezebel and Ahab worship foreign gods, what that means is it's not primarily a worship infraction. It means that they are trying to restructure their society so that the people are understood to be slaves, that the elites are understood to be kind of quasi-gods who are taking the food from the people and living luxurious lives with it because they deserve it. There's no more, helping the poor and the vulnerable and so on. They're peasants. They're supposed to be peasants, right? In ancient Israel, there's no peasants. Everyone is a child of God and actually a bride or husband of God, right? And together, the people constitute this kind of connected body with God. So in the same way that you wouldn't, cheating on a spouse is considered, the ultimate infraction, then cheating with these other gods is said to be an ultimate infraction because it changes the way of your way of life. That's what worshiping a foreign god means. So I think today we have these strange ideas about how someone who, thinks about reads some poetry or does some yoga is an apostate or something. No, it has to do with the way you live your life. And that's also why a lot of the prophets in the Bible say to people who think that they're worshiping Yahweh, you've never been worshiping Yahweh. You've never made your life conform to what Yahweh is asking you to do, right? So all to say, this is why Jezebel is such a kind of bad queen, right? Is that she is tempting Israel not just to worship another god, but to change their entire way of life and to give up on the covenant, to serve Baal and worship him. That word serve here, Ahab and Jezebel went and served, right? I'm going to move this up here just so you can see this. Got to move it up a little bit more here. The king there and served. That word in Hebrew is eved, which means to be a slave. And that they are serving, right? She's telling the people that they are servants and slaves of Baal. And that they are worshiping, which this word in Hebrew here, worship, it means to bow down, but with your whole body and your whole self, to conform yourself to this foreign god, Baal, the master. So you can maybe understand why Elijah, whose name is Eliyahu, my God, is Yahweh. His name, right, is this exclusive claim that there's one God, and that one God is Yahweh. It's important to note that, we'll get to this next week, but in any event, that's kind of the background here for this. Okay, so what did Ahab do then in verse 32 of chapter 16? Ahab erected an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he built in Samaria, so he builds a temple for Baal. Now, again, the altar is important because it's the place that is understood to kind of deal with people's sins in ancient Israel, but it's the place in other traditions, like in the Canaanite worship tradition, this is the place where Baal is given everything, right? So this is like a big deal, right? So Ahab then made an Asherah. This is from Ashtart, one of the goddesses of the Canaanite pantheon. She is the goddess of fertility, fecundity, of life, of growth. So you got Baal, some Baal stuff, some Asherah stuff. This is Canaanite religious tradition. And again, it's not important necessarily because like the name of the god was bad or something, or they were losing worshipers or something, you know. Like, what was important was that this was a different way of life that was being instituted. So then Ahab did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than all the kings of Israel who were before him. So God gets angry about this. Oh, because we're in the Old Testament and God's just angry in the Old Testament, right? No, God gets mad in the New Testament too about this very stuff, when people are changing their way of life to conform to the ways of the world, which is that power is good and people can be subjugated, and people who are in a lower position in life kind of deserve to be there, and they exist for my benefit. I'm taking advantage of other people, right, for my own gain. Those are the things that constitute apostasy, really. Then there's this little thing about Bethel and so on. I'm going to skip that. But now, 1 Kings 17. Now we know a little bit about why it's such a big deal that Elijah breaks into the scene when he does. He's introduced almost as if we kind of already know him a bit. Like, there's not much of an explanation of who he is or why he's here. He probably was a very powerful and important figure in ancient Israelite tradition. So when people heard his name, they probably already knew who he was when this was written down. But here in the story, he breaks in because things have gotten so bad that God needs like the superhero, right? Elijah is a bit like a superhero. He's called a man of God, this kind of prophet that has this special kind of power. He's almost like a portal through which God's power works in the world. Other prophets like Jeremiah just says stuff, right? So Elijah is more than that. God needs something extra, this little window through which God's power, kind of God reaches the divine hand into the world and does some crazy stuff. So that's what Elijah's all about. Now, Elijah, and again, his name is Eliyahu. This is the Hebrew of it above here. Eli means my El, or my God, my high God. Yahu is Yahweh. Yahu is the short form of Yahweh, like a hallelujah, you know, Yah or Yahu is the short form of Yahweh, the particular God of Israel. So now Elijah, the Tishbite of Tishba in Gilead. Now, Tishbite of Tishba, like a Tishbite would mean someone, you know, from this place, Tishba. What's interesting is we don't know a place called Tishba. This doesn't exist. We can't find it in the Bible. We can't find it in any ancient records. By the way, Tishba means wanderers. So I don't think it's a geographical location. I think Elijah is a wanderer from the wanderers who were in Gilead. Now, Gilead's on the far side of the Jordan, the Trans-Jordan. It's in what's now the Kingdom of Jordan. Gilead is was seen as kind of like an external almost for most of Israelite history. It was kind of a quasi-foreign, right? There was a bunch of Israelites who lived there, but like also Arameans and other people and so on. So Elijah is one of these people who, he's a wanderer. He's a nomad. Sounds a little bit like, I don't know, Moses or some of these other folk from the Bible, right? This is kind of an ancient Hebrew thing, the wanderers in the wilderness. But also he's from this kind of foreign-ish place, Gilead. But he's nevertheless this ardent Yahwist. So he himself occupies this position of marginality. But that's what Yahweh is in his message that he enacts, even in this story, is that Yahweh is precisely the God of the margins. You can trace this lineage back to like Moses himself, a marginal person, neither really Egyptian or Hebrew, someone who had murdered someone. He was on the lam. He had run away. He had fought with some local shepherds. You know, he didn't know who he was or where he was, really. He was in a foreign place to him, and he was ostracized by everyone he knew except for this community that had just recently accepted him, of which he had no part, right? So he didn't even know who he was. He named his kid Ger, Wanderer. So Moses is out there in the wilderness, and that's when Yahweh shows up in the bush. And Yahweh picks these slaves who have no place in Pharaoh's culture and breaks apart Pharaoh's culture to free them, and then gives them a home, right? So this God is lives in the wilderness. You know, Mount Sinai is in the middle of nowhere. It's desert land. It's hard to live in. It's a place that in the ancient world, any civilized person, any person living in a city would have called that a demon god, living out in the wilderness. No god wanted to live in the wilderness in the ancient world. They liked their temples, right, in the cities where they got their nice food. So this kind of wandering outsider stuff, this is just the core, really, of what makes Yahweh so strange in the ancient world and distinctive. And this is the distinctive part of the covenant, that no other ancient peoples protect with their law code wandering aliens. No other ancient peoples protect with their law code orphans and widows explicitly, or provide for them, or have a kind of social safety net. No other ancient people does this. Yahweh wants Israel to do this because that's who Yahweh is. Yahweh's the God that looks out for these struggling, vulnerable people and then tells others, you need to help. Like, you need to, because you were slaves in Egypt, I rescued you. Now you know the plight of the wanderer. This is a thing you can see in Exodus and in Deuteronomy, just repeated throughout, that God keeps reminding the people of who they are. So you can see this kind of this is the context in which Elijah makes a lot of sense. This wandering, bizarre, marginal guy who then finds himself in this position of complete vulnerability, and that's when he finds his power. So Elijah, this wandering guy, says to Ahab, the king, as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives. This is an oath. This is the way that they say oaths in ancient Israel. As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, on the life of Yahweh, right? Before whom I stand. And I love that, because what he's saying is, who do you stand before, right? Ahab. Ahab still probably worships Yahweh, right? Like, Ahab worships Yahweh among many other gods in the pantheon. It's kind of the local deity, but he'll worship all the gods, right? And Elijah is saying, there's only one God you can stand before. Who is it? I'm choosing Yahweh. As Yahweh, the Lord. And whenever you see Lord in all caps, by the way, all capital letters, that's Yahweh, the particular name. You can see the Hebrew version right here, Yahweh. The God of Israel lives, before whom I stand. There shall be neither dew nor rain these years except by my word. And then he leaves. So he goes up to the king and he says, I am the one who's going to say, you know, with Yahweh's power, I am going to say whether or not there's going to be rain, even dew, any sort of moisture. Now, the ancient Near East is a dry place, right? So they were always worried about water and water resources. So when Elijah says this, what he's claiming is the power over life, the power over rain and the ability to live and produce things, right? This is also the power that was said to be held by Baal and Asherah. Baal, the power to bring rain and wind and snow and sleet, which, you know, does actually occur in that area, Mount Hermon, to the north of Israel, was said to be kind of the home of Baal, this place that actually has snow on it, and so on. Mount Zaphon, even further north, was understood to be the kind of another home of the main home of Baal. But these kind of tall mountains actually do exist. So Baal would bring this water and these storms and dump it on the land and bring the crops. And Asherah would kind of bring liveliness with her as well and help the plants grow. So worshiping Baal was a way of claiming power over the rain, which was a way of claiming power over the economy. And here Yahweh, through Elijah, is saying, actually, I control that stuff, and I can take it away. I can take away your power. So God is withholding in order to kind of, it's a contest, right? Can Baal bring the rains? Can you pray to Baal? Can the prophets of Baal, the priests of Baal, bring the rains? Just try. So then the word of the Lord came to him, and this is the way that kind of prophetic reception of the messages of the divine world are often framed. The word of the Lord comes to and is received by the prophet. So then he gets a message. Depart from here, God says. Turn eastward and hide yourself by the brook of Cherith, which is east of the Jordan. So go back to like kind of where you come from, east of the Jordan, the Trans-Jordan area across the Jordan, and hide yourself and just go to this like nowhere place, the wilderness. Go into the wilderness and just hide there. You shall drink from the brook, this little river there, the Nahal, which it can mean like big river, but yeah, it doesn't probably here. Yeah, this little brook, and I have commanded the ravens to feed you there. So these kind of nasty carrion birds are going to bring him food. So he went and did according to the word of the Lord. He went and lived by the brook Cherith that is east of the Jordan, And the ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. So Elijah is receiving the things that he needs to get, the sustenance that he needs, from these very unexpected sources. This kind of nasty little brackish creek is providing him enough water to live, and the carrion birds are bringing him enough food to eat so that he can survive. This seems to me to be suggesting that one of the themes here is that God brings life. God, Yahweh, is the God of life, but that life comes from unexpected sources, not just torrential rains in the middle of a beautiful valley made for creating a ton of agricultural products, but God, the true God of the universe, is the God who can eke out life in the margins and is sustaining those people who don't have resources and who are vulnerable. And Elijah here is depending upon that, and he does survive. So Elijah is in this wilderness space, receiving the sustenance that he needs from unexpected sources, even from ravens, these kind of carrion birds that would have been considered unhealthy and unclean, ceremonially unclean in Israelite tradition and in their ritual life. So that's what makes this also coming from an even more unexpected source, a source that someone would have said, That's not even appropriate, right, for you to receive sustenance. I mean, God's working through these ravens. Are you kidding me? This is a recurring theme throughout the work of Elijah and Elisha, God working in unexpected places and through unexpected people. So then 1 Kings 17:7. And then Elijah is sitting there like kind of waiting out the drought, right, because Yahweh is challenging Baal in a way to battle, and Yahweh is trying to stop the rains. And if Baal can make the rains come, then that means that Baal's God, and you know, Baal has beaten Yahweh. So Elijah is just kind of waiting his time during the drought, and of course it's a drought, so the brook dries up. There's no rain in the land, and Elijah is still there in this creek, in this barren place. And it's right then, when all of his sustenance dries up, that God shows up. So we might feel like this in our lives sometimes, that we are we have to kind of wait until all of our resources are gone, and then into that that space of kind of expectant waiting and even the beginning of desperation, that's when God speaks. So then the word of the Lord came to him. So he receives again this message of God. Arise, the Hebrew word get up, kum, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there. Now, this might just kind of be a random place, right? This brook by the Wadi Cherith, right? This kind of place in the Transjordan that he's waiting out at the beginning of this story when the ravens are bringing him food. That's just a nowhere place. But Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, that's not a nowhere place. In the ancient world, this would have been really important because Zarephath was the kind of a suburb of Sidon. Sidon was one of the Phoenician cities, a very strong, powerful cities on the coast north of what the Northern Kingdom of Israel would have been, and west, right on the seacoast there, basically where Lebanon is now. So if you think about kind of the beautiful Lebanon coast, that's Phoenicia. And the Phoenicians were city-states, so Tyre and Sidon and Byblos were Phoenician city-states. The Phoenicians also occupied places like Carthage. They were Punic places, right? So the Phoenicians were Punic people, are Phoenician people, same thing. They had this kind of network of trading across the Mediterranean, so they had these colonies that they put in lots of places around. So Tyre and Sidon, north of Israel, were the two strongholds of the strongest cities of the Phoenician city-state alliance. And this is where, I mean, they were Canaanite people. You know, Phoenicia means purple. Ka'anan or Canaan means purple, just in two different languages. Phoenicia is in Greek, and Ka'anan's in Canaanite or Hebrew. So the Phoenicians are Canaanites. That's what they are. Why are they called purple, by the way? Why was Canaan the purple place? Why are the Phoenicians purple people? Because there was this type of snail you could crush and turn it into purple dye. And it was really a costly thing in the ancient world, signified royalty, and it was greatly valued. So that was the place he went to go get this purple dye. So in any event, this is Canaanite stuff, and these are people who worship Baal. So Elijah is supposed to go into the territory of Jezebel during the drought, and while Baal and Yahweh are fighting, right, symbolically through the weather. I mean, this, you know, this is a big deal to point out, right? You know, and dwell there, go live there, settle down, yashav, it really means to sit, go sit there. And then behold, I have, this is, you know, he's being sent into enemy territory, he's got to stay there. Behold, I have commanded a widow there to feed you. So this word behold, you see this like happen a lot of times in the Old Testament. It's a word, hine, which means right here in Hebrew, hine, behold. It means something's like coming into your view. It's kind of symbolic here, but I mean, the idea is that Yahweh is, God is kind of showing Elijah something. Behold, I have commanded a widow there to feed you. This word tzivi, it's tzava, like if you ever heard someone, a Jewish friend, say, oh, it's a mitzvah, right? This is that same word. So God has commanded this kind of religious commandment, a widow there to feed you. Fascinating thing, right? Because this widow who lives in Sidon is not going to be one who worships Yahweh. They're all Baal worshipers there. So, you know, Yahweh is doing something active and commanding people outside of what everyone understands to be Yahweh's territory to do things to protect Yahweh's prophets. There's a little bit here about kind of the where do Yahweh's boundaries end? There's a consistent theme throughout the Elijah stories, upending the assumptions that Yahweh is a national God, a God who is locally boundaried by Israel and belongs to the Israelite people, but is kind of over against other kingdoms or gods or people. There's this really unexpected aspect. I mean, other peoples would have been very worried and concerned about this. You know, why does your God not love you the most? You know, if like, why would your God want you to talk to other people or try to befriend other people or be priests to the whole world, as Exodus 19 puts it? There's just a whole lot in the ancient world that rides on God's being particular to, like, Marduk is the god of Babylon. In Babylon, they worshipped lots of gods. They recognized there was a pantheon, but they prized Marduk and other gods and goddesses. But Marduk was the special god of Babylon. Yahweh was the special god of Israel, and Baal was the special god of the Phoenicians, of Tyre and Sidon. And so Yahweh commanding the Phoenician to do something is huge. But if Yahweh's got this power, why would Yahweh command a widow? Almuna is the word here, an older woman who has been widowed and kind of is abandoned in a way. I mean, in ancient culture, you know, the women who were widowed and had not remarried or were protected in some way by a larger family were extremely vulnerable, were often taken advantage of. These are the people who are protected under Israelite law. Yahweh loves these people. So Yahweh's got this special connection to them, which is amazing because if you're going to go into enemy territory, you probably don't want the widow taking, like, you know, helping you with your mission. You know, you can imagine like a special agent, you know, like jumping out of a plane and, you know, skydiving silently into somewhere in the middle of the night and meets their special agent, and it's like an impoverished elderly person. You know, the Tom Cruise, you know, in Mission Impossible might say, this isn't going to work out, right? But Elijah, he goes with it because he trusts that Yahweh is there. So this woman is going to feed him. So again, this concern throughout the Elijah stories about food and eating. We can already see here that rains, that worship of certain gods and so on is connected to this kind of health of the land and the health of the people. We'll see that food plays a really symbolic role throughout the Elijah and Elisha stories as the way that God has provided for the world to give us health and well-being. But it's health in this very holistic sense. And we'll see the health part next week when we talk about a dead child who Elijah performs a miracle on. So Elijah hears this message. He's got to go to Zarephath. So he got up and he went to Zarephath. It's the same exact verbs used in verse 10 as in verse 9. He always says, get up and go. So he got up and he went to show his obedience, right? And he went to Zarephath. So he goes into enemy territory. And when he came to the gate of the city, the place where like people are checking you out and like inspecting you, and like he might just get executed there. But behold, a widow was there gathering sticks. And Elijah calls to her and he says, hey, bring me a little water in my vessel that I may drink. You'll notice that people in ancient Israelite stories always sound impolite, because for us, hello and kind of introducing yourself is polite. but also it's often polite to say please and thank you. You'll notice they don't say any of those things in ancient Israelite stories. It just wasn't a part of really this ancient culture, and more broadly, speaking of the ancient Near East. So he's a traveler, and there was a general idea in the ancient world that you should be hospitable to travelers, but at the same exact time, there was all this advice to say, don't help travelers, because travelers, we don't know where they come from. Maybe they're scouting us out to attack us, but also in a water-scarce environment. Obviously, in Phoenicia, they have lots of water, but it's salty water, right? I mean, clean, fresh drinking water is still scarce there. So if someone comes and asks for your scarce resources and you don't know them, it's not only a threat to you, but it's kind of an insult too. So other ancient cultures, they're not sharing their water with you unless you have something to give them, right? Or unless you have weapons with you and demand it. But in ancient Israel, there was this strange commandment to take care of wandering aliens, the only culture that we have a law about. Ancient Israel says you have to take care of wandering people because you used to be wandering people yourselves, is the way that both Exodus and Deuteronomy put it. But then God also says that you have to take care of the orphans and the widows, people who are vulnerable and cannot take care of themselves. Yahweh is their defender, and Yahweh is their friend. And Yahweh tells you that you need to be that too if you're going to be a part of the covenant. The covenant is shaping a people who have a mission. And that mission is to be God in the world, but also to help mediate God's love for the world and help restore the world. So in any event, kind of feeding the stranger, taking care of the stranger is hugely important throughout the Bible, and continues to be an important issue for us to think about today. It is interesting that that's not recognized as the most distinctive aspect of American Christianity right now, but it's definitely the most distinctive aspect, along with monotheism of ancient Israelite traditions. So, in any event, interesting thing for us to think about. But Elijah says to this woman, this poor woman, bring me some water in a vessel that I may drink. And she's gathering sticks outside by the gate of the city. She's not in good circumstances. This is not something someone with a healthy bank account does in the ancient world. They didn't really have bank accounts. But anyway, you know what I mean? Someone who has significant resources. This is kind of a right by the city gate too. There's not a whole lot of stuff growing there. It's kind of this desperate move, and he's asking her for water, this precious resource. So you might imagine you see someone, picking through a trash can, near a downtown close to you, and you might walk up to them and say, "Hey, can you spare me some change?" You know, it would be kind of strange and off-putting and maybe even insulting, but Elijah says to this woman, bring me not only water, but something to drink it in. I need cups too. It's really asking, being vulnerable himself and asking for sustenance because he needs it. He also believes that God has commanded this woman, and that this woman is going to do what God wants. Even though she's a stranger, a foreigner, a vulnerable person you wouldn't expect to have these resources. But not only that, but it turns out it's even worse. Right? So this woman is, in a way, kind of like the ravens to him right now. She's an outcast in her own culture. She's an outcast. She's a Phoenician, right, in relation to Israelites. She's a Baal worshiper, probably. Not only that, she's a widow in a culture that doesn't take care of widows. And not only that, she's poor, right? So she's desperate. But nevertheless, as she was going to bring it, he called to her. I mean, this is amazing. She actually leaves her stuff and goes, and that's how he knows that this is the right woman, right? He called to her and he said, "Bring me a morsel of bread in your hand." So just like, give me some food too, So she's already going to get the one. And he recognizes that she's someone who is attuned to hospitality for wandering people. So maybe she's got some food for him too. And she said, "As the Lord your God lives." Now remember, when it's all in all caps, that's the particular name. That's the name of Yahweh. So as Yahweh your God lives. Now notice it's your God, right? Your God. So not her God, right? Yahweh is his God. She recognizes from his speech that he's an Israelite, one of those people who worships Yahweh. And so she's swearing by the life of his God. Because if she swears by the life of her God, but he doesn't believe, he doesn't sort of follow that God or know that God, he's one of those weird Israelites. So I probably should swear by his God so that he knows what I'm talking about and that I'm serious. And then she says, "I have nothing baked, I have no bread, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil in a jug. And now I am gathering a couple of sticks that I may go in and prepare it for myself and my son that we may eat it and die. So a last meal is happening here, or a last supper, maybe I should say. The people who are vulnerable and who are starving are going to have one last meal and then give up. They're on the edge of giving up. And notice that response. You know, this is, they live in a culture that doesn't take care of them. They live in a culture that is oppressing them and then taking as much as it can from them. Of course, she might believe this is like what Baal wants, you know, so we're just going to give up because we can't make it anymore. They've run out of their food and their source of their well-being and their life. There's no more life in the land for them, so they're going to give up their lives in return. But then Elijah says to her, "Do not fear." Do not fear. This word here, al tirah, in Hebrew, do not fear. A fantastically important phrase. This is said by many prophets, other people too, but primarily this is the way that you start an oracle of salvation. So when Isaiah says, do not fear, it's like once upon a time is the way that you begin a fairy tale. Do not fear is the way that you begin an oracle of salvation. And there's two different ways to say no or do not in Hebrew. One means never, and one means just not now. So if I talk to my kids and I say, don't ever jump on the bed, I'll say lo, like that kind of no. And if I tell the kids, like, don't touch that plate now because it's hot, but you can touch the plate later, you know, I'd say al, don't now do that thing. So al tirah means don't be scared right now. You don't have to be afraid right now. So fear is good. You know, fear keeps us alive and God put it in us for a reason. But it can overtake us and overwhelm us. And there are certain times we get scared and we shouldn't be. So this woman is about to have her last meal. And Elijah says, you don't have to be scared anymore. It's a symbol, right? It's kind of a word symbol saying God is here, God is with you, God will do something. And prophets often say this. So she receives an oracle of salvation, this foreign woman, a vulnerable woman. People in Jesus's day, you can read about this in Luke chapter 4, got real mad that Elijah went to a foreign land and helped foreign people, these foreign vulnerable women, you know, who were like losers in their own day and age. And God, through Elijah, helped them, but God didn't heal all the people in Israel who needed help, who deserved it. Of course, you can imagine what Jesus has to say to that. So Elijah says to this woman, brings the oracle of salvation to her and her son in extension, do not fear, go and do as you have said, which means like go eat the last meal and die, right? No, I mean, but just go get the food. But first, make me a little cake of it and bring it to me, and afterward, make something for yourself and your son. So Elijah is not, you know, at first it might sound like he's saying, yeah, go ahead and die, just say a little bit of it for me. But then he clarifies quickly in verse 14, for thus says the Lord, the God of Israel. And thus says the Lord, Ko Amar Adonai, it's right over here in Hebrew, Ko Amar Adonai, thus says the Lord. This is the messenger formula. You'd say this not just for talking about a God. You'd say this about for any important person when you brought their message. So thus says King David, Ko Amar David. So here, Elijah is using the messenger formula, Ko Amar Yahweh. Yahweh has said. Thus says Yahweh. So he's giving the message. And the idea here is that the person is supposed to know that this is the real words of Yahweh. And this is, you know, a God is on her side. For thus says the Lord, Yahweh, the God of Israel. And I love it because, yeah, Yahweh is the God of Israel. But he's talking to this person who's not an Israelite. She might imagine he's going to say, what, that guy wants to kill me or whatever, you know. But here, the God of Israel is Yahweh. And that the God of Israel wants to take care of people outside the boundaries of Israel. And not just anyone, not just the important people or something, but wants to start. The God of Israel wants to start with the margins of this foreign land. People who hate Yahweh. Yahweh wants to start to heal them. So the jar of flour shall not be spent, and the jug of oil shall not be empty until the day that the Lord sends rain upon the earth. And that, of course, is referencing that conversation that Elijah had with Ahab when he said there's not going to be any rain. So here you understand that there's like also a drought up there too. You know, this is like hurting the land. However, Yahweh is going to bring unending oil and flour to this woman. So this kind of surplus of life-giving resources, right? This is what Asherah would give or what Baal would give, right? So Yahweh says, I can do that. I can hold the reins and I can give you food, right? Because it's life. Yahweh is the one who brings life. the God of life. And we'll see that in next week's story as well, that Yahweh is in more ways than one the God of life. So the Lord will send rain upon the earth, and then then this will stop. But for that time being, this woman not only gets resources that help her live, the resources that help her life, but she's going to get unending supplies, which means she's going to have lots of resources for a while, right? She can give away or sell some of this flour and oil and so on. This is a little image of an abundance, a community of abundance. There was more than enough food in Sidon to feed all of the widows that lived there, but they chose not to use their resources that way. The ancient world, like the modern world, was framed around a culture of scarcity, the idea that we never have enough. In response to that, Yahweh brings a culture of excess and abundance. There is an abundance of life, unending sources of life. We have more than we need, and the key to learning that we have more than we need is to begin to give things away. To start by noticing people who do not have, and starting to fix the problem there, not just by giving one day of things, but as Yahweh gives unending supplies, right, of the things that people need for life. It's an alternative vision of how the world might work. So then in verse 15, so she goes and she does just like Elijah said. That same verb there, to go, she went, as Elijah said, and she and her household ate for many days. So she did that, and it worked, right? The jar of flour was not spent, neither did the jug of oil. Oh, and by the way, the household is important there, too. It's her household, right? The bait there. So like anyone who was attached to her, and a house doesn't just mean a physical house. It also doesn't just mean like a biological kin. It means whoever wants to kind of, whoever depends upon you for something. So this woman begins to support many people for many days with this abundance. And so that shows that she got the message, right? Not only was she sensitive to a wandering person in her midst, she was sensitive to the call to help that person with scarce resources that she barely had enough for herself. And then as a result, it turns out there was abundance for many, and that her actions supported many in that time of need. So, something important for us too. The jar of flour was not spent, neither did the jug of oil become empty, according to the word of the Lord that he spoke, that God spoke by Elijah. So the end of that is important there, because the whole point of this is to show who Yahweh is, the word of Yahweh, and that Yahweh's power is to bring new life. This is an answer to the question in the Jesus stories of like, why did Jesus not heal everyone, right? Which like, maybe you thought that, like, why did Jesus heal some people but not everyone? If you are struggling with a sickness, you might be wondering, why isn't God heal me or a family member? For some reason, God doesn't heal everyone. And in fact, God doesn't heal most people who are sick of things. Everyone has a terminal disease of life, right? Which ends at some point. Why would this be, right? Well, Jesus's miracles are real. They heal people, but they are symbolic as well. That is, they're symbolizing a transformative power that God has to bring new life. And that Jesus doesn't come just to like do this for us. Jesus comes primarily in order to create a new community of people who are empowered with the mission to go out and heal the world by praying at some points, but also by doing. So I think this is connected in many ways to the formation of ancient Israel as a people. Like in Exodus 19, the people are called together and God says to them on the foot of the mountain of Sinai, God says, I want you to be for me a priestly people, like to all the nations of the world. Like you're a nation that's supposed to be mediating my love and power and healing power with to the rest of the earth. And this is part of God's plan to fix the earth, to create the kind of community that God actually wants and envisions, hopes for, and will someday get, because God is God. So this kind of call, this mission, you can see, is inaugurated and witnessed to by these miracles. But the miracles don't fix everything. That's not the point. The point is to begin a community that then carries forward the work of those who have been called to follow God and serve God. Serve God in the sense that you're going out and being agents of God's reconciling and empowering and enlivening love to bring peace or blessing to the world. It's the kind of stuff that Jesus talks about too in the Sermon on the Mount and many other places. So in any event, this validation of the prophet's ministry by these miraculous acts that also symbolize the kind of community that God is trying to create, inspire, and empower. That I think is key to understanding these stories of Elijah and Elisha and why they do things that confuse us as well as inspire us. So next week we'll talk about the son of this woman, starting in verse 17. There's a sad story that follows, and we're going to focus on that story of death and life next time. See you then.